The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. 25 years ago, I did an interview with Joe Fenley for a book he wrote about a story he covered when he was a newspaper reporter in Dayton. And this is a story that just wouldn't go away for Joe Fenley. And if you listen to the program last Saturday morning when I had Kristen von Kreisler on, you might recall that her book had been orphaned. The publisher had let her editor go and her publicist right when the book came out. And so no one was promoting her book. She had to do it herself. Well, 25 years ago, I encountered a lot of writers like that. And with the publishing industry, the way that it's gone in the last 25 years, there are a lot more of them like that now, much more self-publishing going on. Writers who find it a lot easier to publish by self-publishing than it was 25 years ago. Well, back in 2001, Joe Fenley self-published this story that just would not go away. If you've been a reader of the Dayton Daily News for a long time, you might recall the name Joe Fenley. Joe was a reporter back in the 1970s for the Dayton Daily News. He eventually became managing editor. He was originally from Staten Island, and during this conversation, you could hear that Staten Island accent was still there, and just a dogged reporter. He had covered this story where a man might have murdered his wife. Might. It took forever to prove it, but they finally did, and it's a fascinating story. And back in those days, the newspapers covered a lot more stuff. A reporter like Joe Fenley would go out and be right on top of those stories. And in this situation, there's one part of the story where this man who probably murdered his wife then ended up living with his stepchildren, who really didn't like or trust him very much. And they eventually left and moved in with the grandparents just to get away from him. And then he had a big sale, a big house sale at his house, and he was selling all of his wife's possessions, all of the family photos, all these sentimental things that belonged to the children. And the children came to the sale and were picketing the sale. They were carrying signs saying, "Don't buy from this sale." And, of course, the Dayton Daily News had reporters and photographers out there taking pictures of this. Can you imagine? This is back in the 1970s, different times. Joe Fenley died on February 5th, 2008. He was 74. And I have to feel that he would appreciate it, that 25 years after he did this interview, this story is still alive, because for Joe Fenley, it just would not go away. He reported on it. It took 9 years for justice to finally take place and for this guy who apparently did kill his wife to go to prison. Let's listen now as we hear about the deadly groom. It's true crime on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today my guest is Joe Fenley. His book is called The Deadly Groom, an Ohio-Arkansas true crime saga. Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Joe, this book, I used this word earlier. I don't know if you heard me describe it this way, but would you call this an obsession?
Almost an obsession. I was never able to let this story go. It's primarily because it it dragged on for so many years, from the time of Marcia's death, originally thought to be an accidental death while fishing, and it dragged on for more than 15 years before the man who was finally convicted of killing her died in prison. And like many news stories that go on that many years, it just got lost in the shuffle, sort of. And I just could not, I kept thinking there's got to be a book in this. There's got to be a way to pull all of this together into one package so that people can know what it was really like and what happened.
Tell us about your background. You're a journalist.
I was. I'm retired now. I was a reporter for many years for the Dayton Daily News. I ran the New York office for several years of a weekly magazine. Came back to the Dayton Daily News as a junior editor and assistant city editor.
Now when you bang that, it sounds like you're in a submarine. So.
As an assistant city editor, later the metro editor, and then for the last 13 years I was at the Dayton paper. I was the managing editor, and I retired at the end of 88 and went into teaching, and then did that for a long time and retired from that. But the book was always hung with me after that, the idea of that I really should try and do a book about it. And I finally decided I am going to do it after I retired from teaching. And I sat down and started lining out what I would have to do to get a book together on it. And while I was in the process of doing that, the man who was sent to prison for killing Marcia Good, died in prison. And I figured, well, that's the end of the book. I can't confront him in prison and talk to him about what happened. And my wife talked me out of it. She said, you go ahead and do the book anyway. You know, that there's got to be a lot of information in there that people don't know about. There are people who've never had a chance to say their piece about it. See what you can do. And I decided I'd go ahead, and I did.
Now, Joe, often in life we see that one tragedy leads to another. And the first tragedy here was the death of a colleague.
Jim Good was the business editor at the Dayton Daily News. He came down with a brain tumor, and he died of the brain tumor eventually. He died in October of 1976, leaving his wife Marcia with three children, and a hard way to go to raise those children and put them through college. And yes, it did lead to the tragedy, because within a year after the death of her husband, she decided that she would have to change her lifestyle, and that might mean marrying again. And she tried to put herself in a position where she would meet decent men, including a place called Parents Without Partners in the Dayton area that sponsor affairs.
And it's a good organization.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's a very good organization.
Yeah.
But Richard Bennett used places like that to prey on people. So she went with a good heart, and he went with a bad heart, and looking for someone to exploit.
And she was looking for security for her children, and she thought she had found it when she met this man, because this man was a liar.
He was a pathological liar. He would lie even if the truth would do him better. But he put on a false front of being a successful builder, that he was a millionaire, that he was going to love her and cherish her and take care of her children, and he would build her a wonderful new home on 5 acres, and they would have a horse barn and so on. And what he was really after was her own little modest estate, the money that she could get from selling the family house, the money that she got from the insurance policy when her husband died. Any little thing that he could get his hands on. In that case, it amounted to somewhere between $120,000 and $150,000, probably, that he bilked.
And she was an ideal victim for him, because she really wanted to take care of her kids, and she was in a bad situation. She didn't do her research on him at all.
No, and there's a cautionary tale in there. Any woman who is in a similar situation should be very, very careful.
Let's talk about this.
Because he had victimized other women before her,
yeah,
but not with that tragic a result, and he victimized women after her.
Richard Bennett, I think the word that comes to mind when I think of him is creep.
Evil is my own feeling about him, that he was a thoroughly evil person, that he always knew what he was doing. It was always to his own benefit. He had no remorse, no conscience, no sense of guilt. Whatever he wanted to do, whatever he thought was good for him, he would do. He offered to kill the wife, the estranged wife of a friend, and it was almost like a blueprint for Marcia's death. They would drown this man's wife. They would collect insurance money on her death, and it was almost like a harbinger of things to come.
My guest is Joe Fenley. The book is The Deadly Groom, an Ohio-Arkansas true crime saga. He joins us in the Book Nook today. You've done a lot of research on this Richard Bennett character, and I was amazed by his history throughout this region. This guy had connections in Belle Fountain, in Troy, in Piqua, in Sydney, in Centerville, all over the map.
He would move from one place to another after he had worn out his welcome in one place, when enough people came to realize that he was not a good guy. And he would move on and start over again. He's a very complex man, though. He had one wife. He was married three times before he married Marcia. He married twice more after Marcia's death. Most of them lasted less than a year, but one lasted 19 years. He fathered many children out of wedlock and had to be hauled into court each time to make modest payments for the upkeep of the child. He defrauded companies. He was given to violent acts. In one situation, he was charged with felony charges against him for destroying a judge's car. He didn't realize at the time that it was a judge's car that he was destroying. It was parked in an alley next to his house, and he went across to the house, the other house, and told the people he wanted the car moved. And when it wasn't moved quickly enough to suit his satisfaction, he demolished it. He ended up being charged with felony charges, and he was lucky he got out from under it. But he was a violent man. He had been arrested for fighting with policemen. He was a drunk at least sometimes. But he put on a facade of being the gentle giant and being a very charming, loving kind of guy. People who were in prison with him came to respect him. They thought that he was a good man, that he looked out for the underdog in prison, and maybe to some extent he did.
Well, he found the Lord.
Well, if he found the Lord, then he wrote off everything that he had done before he found the Lord. That's the only way to look at it, because he only apologized once in his entire life that I know of, and that was to one of his ex-wives, in which he wrote her a letter and said that she was the most wonderful person that he had ever met in his life, and he regretted the way he had treated her, and he didn't expect her to forgive him, but he just wanted her to know that he had found the Lord and he had changed his ways. But that being said, he still married two more times. And one of those women, when she got divorced from him, wanted a protective order from the court to keep him away from her because she feared for her life. And the other woman, he bilked her out of money, and in her divorce complaint against him, she wanted the money returned to her that he had bilked her out of on the sale of her home. And so he was running true to form, but maybe in smaller ways still.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 25 years to an interview I did with Joe Fenley, a former Dayton Daily News reporter who wrote a book, a true crime story, The Deadly Groom, an Ohio-Arkansas true crime saga. He reported on this story, and it just would not go away. It just haunted Joe Fenley, and he self-published this book 25 years ago. And if you're into true crime, it's a great read. We'll bring you more of that conversation right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO at 91.3 on your dial, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. Revisiting an interview I did 25 years ago with the late Joe Fenley. He was born on Staten Island on July 13, 1933. He died on February 5, 2008, at the age of 74. This is a book that haunted him, the story about the deadly groom. And it's just an amazing story. This guy murdered his wife and was kind of getting away with it, but justice finally caught up with him. You know, sometimes it takes a while. Let's listen.
The book is The Deadly Groom. Joe Fenley wrote it, and he joins us in the Book Nook today. Okay, they meet at Parents Without Partners. She's looking for someone to provide for her three young children. Her husband left her with a life insurance policy. She doesn't want to touch that. It's like $50,000. She doesn't want to touch it because she wants to save it for her kids' college education. They're living on Social Security payments that the kids are receiving. She's trying to continue payments on their house. Mm-hmm. She's got some equity in the house. Okay, along comes Mr. Evil. Let's do the timeline now of what transpired. They didn't move in together right away, did they?
Oh, no, they didn't move in. They met in about September of 1977. December 15th, 1977, his divorce from his long-time wife, Marilyn, was final. The 27th of December, Bennett and Marcia got married.
Still didn't move in with her, though.
Nope. Okay. Nope. In fact, there was probably a period of at least a month or so before he moved in with her, sometime in January of 1978. March of 78, they go away on a part business, part pleasure trip down to near Paris, Arkansas, where he thought he might want to build a package store, where Paris, being in a dry county and across the river, where a new bridge was going in, was a dry county. And he thought a package store would be a good investment down there. Anyway, there was a bridge being built. He took her fishing on that fateful day on March 25, 1978. And they went out on the bridge to fish. And he came back alive and she came back dead. And there was an investigation of sorts, but say Montgomery County in Ohio, Sheriff Vore has a staff of a couple hundred people. The sheriff in Logan County had a staff of four, including himself. And yet the county was so big that they had to have two courthouses. It was that geographically that large.
Wow.
So there wasn't a great deal that a small-town sheriff could do in a way of in-depth criminal investigation.
Plus, she wasn't a local.
She was not a local, no. This was, and that partly had a lot to do later with people's, particularly the prosecutor's mindset shortly down the road. But the sheriff there did invite the state police in. They do homicide investigations in Arkansas, unlike the state patrol in Ohio. And it was determined to be kind of a suspicious nature anyway, if nothing else. Her body didn't surface until another 10 days after she died.
And he was long gone.
Well, he was back in Ohio. He told them, the law enforcement officers down there, he just had to get back to Ohio because the children needed him so badly.
And, right.
Because they were emotionally distraught over the death of their mother, and they needed him to console them. And when her body surfaced, the state medical examiner's office did the autopsy. But my own belief at this point, in looking at all the documents I had available to me, that they did a fairly cursory autopsy because they were assuming that it was an accidental drowning, and they did not investigate it as if full-blown, as if it was a possible homicide. And as soon as the body was released, Bennett had the body cremated. And he said that that was her wish. But everybody else in the family said, no, that would never have been her wish.
She also didn't like fishing, did she?
No, she did not. In fact, her first husband, Jim Good, he would take the kids fishing, but if Marcia could get out of going, she would. She just didn't like it. It just wasn't her thing.
And it was a cold, windy, rainy night.
Stormy night. It was, the temperature was down a little over 30 with the wind chill factor. It might have been down to about 20. It was raining. It was cold. It was pitch black out there on his bridge under construction. One woman had said that he took her there one
time. And said it'd be a great place for a murder.
Great place for a murder. Well, it turned out it basically was.
Oh, yes. My.
And
unbelievable. Well, okay, it's all true. It is believable.
I think it's true, and I think it's believable.
The book is The Deadly Groom by Joe Fenley. Now, Joe, you went back and you put together all the pieces. There were three trials for this guy?
Three trials. The first trial was in Paris, Arkansas, which is in Logan County. He was convicted in a trial that took about 4 days. But the Arkansas Supreme Court overturned that conviction on the grounds that there were errors in the first trial, including the fact that the defense in that case prior to trial had asked to be able to videotape defense witnesses who would not be able to be there for the trial, and that those people were in Ohio. The prosecution said, well, we have witnesses in Ohio too. What, judge, why don't you let us videotape our witnesses there and we'll get all these depositions taken at one time. And the judge said, okay. Arkansas Supreme Court said, no way, that the jury must have an opportunity, unless there's a showing that that witness will not be able to be there for trial, that the jury has a right to be able to observe that witness in person and make their own decision about whether he or she is telling the truth or not. So that was a primary cause. The court also pointed out several other things that it would have reversed on. It was almost like they were teaching him, the judge, law 101 about how to conduct the trial. The second trial, he avoided all of those pitfalls. But he made a second mistake. He decided in his own mind that he didn't like the way jury instructions were given. And he decided he would give them at the beginning of the trial rather than at the end, which is the customary way and the way most jurisdictions require. He thought it would be better to talk to the jurors ahead of time. When that trial was over and Bennett was convicted again, the defense attorney made a motion, asked the judge to repeat all of the jury instructions that he had given at the start of the trial. The judge declined. He refused to do it. He said that they will have the transcripts. They'll have written transcripts of what I said. They don't need those. But he did go ahead and address the jury about two other points of law that came up during the trial that he had not covered in his opening instructions to the jury. The Supreme Court of Arkansas again overturned the conviction on the grounds that you can't do that, that Arkansas law is very specific, and it says that they must be given at the end of the trial. And absent that, if either the prosecution or the defense say, I want them done, the judge has no choice but to do it, but he refused. So the conviction was overruled, again, on a technical, not on the merits of the case.
So these were technicalities pointed out by an excellent lawyer who represented him.
Absolutely. Asa Hutchinson was a former U.S. attorney in Arkansas for the Western Division of Arkansas. In fact, in one case, he successfully prosecuted Roger Clinton, Bill Clinton's brother, on drug charges. And he was well known for a variety of other really high-profile cases in Arkansas. And then he ran for Attorney General of Arkansas and was defeated and then went back into private practice. And so he was a defense attorney at the time that Bennett was charged. He was Bennett's paid attorney for the first trial. He was Bennett's paid attorney for the second trial. He also handled Bennett's appeals to the Arkansas Supreme Court, to the U.S. District Court, and to the U.S. Supreme Court. And
he did a good job.
And he did, and he's excellent. I mean, there's no question. He's just excellent. And
he got this weasel out of the first trial, out of the second trial, but then the third trial, he was indigent.
For the third trial, Bennett said, I have no more money. I've got to have a court-appointed attorney. And the judge said, fine, we'll give you one. And they did, a man named Robert E. Doc Irwin, who is also, comes across as an aw shucks country boy, but he's like a Wall Street lawyer, though, and very sharp. And he did a very good job of, under the circumstances that he had to live with, because Bennett decided that he demanded to be his own co-counsel in the third and final trial.
Always a fatal error.
A fatal error, having, you know, an attorney who represents himself as a fool for a client. Well, I think it's pretty clear that by a lot of the things that Bennett did in that trial, as he represented himself as co-counsel, that he probably alienated the jury very quickly. And he also did some bizarre things. Because he was trying to act like Perry Mason, he referred to himself like it was another person. It was in the third person. Did Mr. Bennett ever do this? Did Mr. Bennett ever do that? And people would look at him and say, well, you did, you know, or whatever. Witnesses. And so it turned that trial into a little bit into, had a circus atmosphere about it to a certain extent. But Doc Irwin did the best that he could in representing Bennett under the circumstances. And yet, when that trial was over and he was convicted for the third time, Bennett wanted it appealed again. But this time he came up with more money to go back and hire Asa Hutchinson again. And Asa, again, represented him on appeal. But this time, the Arkansas Supreme Court did not overturn the conviction. They sustained the conviction. There was a, at one point there, Doc Irwin had run into one of the jurors outside the courthouse after the trial was over. And the woman mentioned living in this town, a certain town. Don't you live there too? And he said, yes. And he said, well, so do I. And
oops.
Because he realized she did not live in the county in which the trial was held. So he tried to have the raise that as one of the first points of any appeal by anybody. And the judge threw that out on the grounds that it was unintentional on the woman's part, that she truthfully answered all of the questions on the questionnaire, that she truthfully answered all of the questions that were asked of her, and that everybody accepted her as a juror. And it just was beyond her knowledge that she was not suitable as a juror in that case. She had been called, and she appeared, and she was seated, and she served. And the Supreme Court in Arkansas ruled the same way, that there was nothing improper about how she was seated as a juror. They just happened to have an old mailing address and put her in the jury wheel as a resident of that county, and she didn't know any better.
And ultimately, after the third trial, Richard Bennett was locked up for good and did die in prison.
We're talking about that deadly groom in the Book Nook this morning, going back 25 years. Joe Fenley, the reporter who covered it for the Dayton Daily News, wrote this book and self-published it back in 2001. And we'll bring you the final segment of that interview right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. revisiting an interview I did a quarter of a century ago. And over the last 25 years, true crime stories have become a phenomenon. I know so many people who listen to true crime podcasts, who read true crime books, who watch true crime on TV. It's just fascinating. It's kind of like watching a car wreck. It's kind of gross, but you can't look away, right? You're fascinated by it. Well, Joe Fenley was completely fascinated by this murder. He covered it as a reporter for the Dayton Daily News, and then he went on to write a book about it. Let's listen to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO.
My guest is Joe Fenley. The book is The Deadly Groom. It's a true story. Now, I think his biggest mistake was he acted in such a callous and crass fashion after her death. The things he did to her children, the things he did to her estate, aroused the ire of her late husband's brother.
Dr. Lowell Good. Dr. Good, at first, when first informed of Marcia's death, and the first time Bennett talked to him about it, Dr. Good was inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt and to say, let's give this man a chance. But the way that Bennett acted toward the children in the period immediately after their mother's death, and the nature of some of the things that he said about Marcia, uncomplimentary things.
Like she was having an affair.
Well, he did accuse her of that eventually.
Uh-huh. Which was an absolute fabrication.
To the best of my knowledge, it was, yes. That I think that what Bennett wanted was whatever he could get out of her estate, including, backing up just a little bit. Dr. Good became, if not suspicious, at least disenchanted with Bennett early on. It wasn't very long, within a week or so after Marcia's death, Dr. Good was forming opinions that this just didn't look right at all. And now, ultimately, he did come to the newspaper, my newspaper, the Dayton Daily News, to express some concerns about whether this was truly an accident and to ask us to look into it more. But he went out and hired investigators of his own to look into Bennett's background and just came up with all kinds of information about him. Among other things, though, is one of the things that really irked an awful lot of people was when Bennett decided that he would auction off the contents of Marcia's house. And this included a whole lot of things that had, if not great monetary value, terrific sentimental value to the children, things of their fathers, trinkets that their mother had, although Marcia also had some expensive jewelry, but their own bicycles, just personal belongings.
And the kids weren't even living there anymore.
No, they had moved out to go live with their grandparents because they just didn't feel comfortable. They didn't feel comfortable around Bennett. They felt that he was being mean to them. They didn't trust him. They didn't think he was up to any good. Then Gloria, at least, was the oldest. She was 15 at the time. And I think she came to conclude that there was something really wrong about her mother's death. Now, even Gloria would say years later in testimony that she wasn't sure where that doubt first came in her mind, whether it was something that one of the grandparents said or whether Dr. Good said something or whether she reached it on her own. But she also came to suspect that this was not an accidental drowning.
And Bennett had her make out a new will just a few days before her death, giving him everything and the kids nothing.
Left everything to Bennett and nothing to the children. He had also taken out a life insurance policy on her life, naming him as the sole beneficiary. And this was a stunt that he had done with other women, telling them that their children were the beneficiaries. What he told Marcia was it didn't make any difference whose name was on the will as the beneficiary, because since she had children, they would automatically come first in line, which was nonsense. I mean, that's not the way the law reads.
And there was one woman who he tried to get a life insurance policy, and she couldn't qualify, and she lived.
Right. But he had done the same thing to her. She didn't find out until years later that on that application, he listed himself as the sole beneficiary, even though he told her that her children were going to be the beneficiaries.
So they're having this auction, and the kids are actually picketing the auction.
As along with an aunt, Lois Zoll, who actually spent hundreds of dollars of her own money buying back some of the things anyway, that the kids could have a few of their mementos.
This is really sick stuff. Now, the Dayton Daily News was out there covering this, weren't they?
Absolutely, yes, with photographs and kids holding up signs, please don't buy anything here.
And yet this wasn't a red flag yet.
No, well, there were so many things. You know, that's not evidence of a murder. Things that Dr. Good's investigators turned up and that the police turned up were not necessarily evidence that would stand up in court. They were things that people said about Bennett, possibly. There were some things that were on the record. There were criminal actions in which he was involved, relatively minor in nature. But there were people who were who thought that he was a really evil person and a real bad man. But that, again, doesn't hold any weight in a court of law. You can't take somebody in on because somebody suspects somebody or they don't like them or anything. And it was, I think, a linchpin in that case was Dr. Good, and he's told me this a number of times, that he was just determined that this was not going to go away, that Bennett was not going to be able to walk away from this, that as far as Dr. Good was concerned, he had come to the final, absolute conviction that Bennett had murdered Marcia and was not going to get away with it. He was in constant contact with people like the chief investigator for the Arkansas State Police, whose name escapes me at the moment, Doug Stevens. And Doug Stevens, even though he had constraints on him, Doug Stevens took a good circumstantial evidence case to the Logan County prosecutor to try and have Bennett charged with murder. And the prosecutor at the time said, oh, I don't think so. There's just not enough evidence here. It's a pretty circumstantial case. That prosecutor also pointed out that they were out-of-state people, that Bennett and Marcia did not live in Arkansas, that it would be difficult to go into Ohio and mount an investigation and try and collect evidence and to get him extradited to go to Arkansas and so on. And I think the man didn't want the case. It was easier to have a slam dunk case. There are enough capital murder cases in Arkansas where it happens, you know, on Main Street at high noon with two guys with guns and one guy lives and one guy doesn't, and the survivor gets charged with murder. The next prosecutor, the next elected prosecutor in Logan County, came pretty close to taking Stevens' words and filing charges, and at one point said he really thought he would, but he needed a little more time. And then finally, when he made his final decision, he decided, no, same thing. We'd need some more evidence. And there just wasn't any more to be found at that point. Well, Dr. Good took another tack. He went the civil case route, in which he got his nephew, David Zoll, to file a wrongful death action in federal court. And it was filed within a day or so before the statute of limitations for that kind of a lawsuit expired. And in it, for the first time, Actually, the accusation was made on in a public record that accusing Bennett of killing Marcia for profit. And
Would this be the equivalent of the O.J. Sybil thing? Where they
yes, did... but that came after the the acquittal. You know, it was the other way around.
Okay.
This one, it came first. They had the civil case. In fact, there had been other civil cases before. There had been a Will Contes case that Dr. Good had financed, challenging the validity of that will signed just a couple of days before she died. But then the wrongful death action in federal court in Toledo, Ohio, was really the linchpin, because that was when they were able to bring a number of witnesses who could testify about Bennett and so on. The jury there, they were faced with, since it was a civil case, they had instructions from the judge there too. And there were two layers of that. One was whether Bennett had just been extremely negligent. And the other one was whether he had intentionally killed his wife. So the jury went out to deliberate on those, ponder either that or say no, he wasn't guilty of any of them. The jury foreman came back and said they had a question for the judge, and he wanted to know, the jury wanted to know, if they could find for the plaintiffs, for the Good family, on both counts, that he was extremely negligent and that he had done it intentionally for money. And the judge said, folks, you got to pick one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have both. So they came back and awarded $547,000 in damages to the Good family, to the children, on the grounds that he had intentionally murdered his wife. That was a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing about it was that somebody finally said, in a court of law that had some power to do so, that this man killed somebody. Now, it was a civil case, so... On the bad side, though, is it meant that the Goods weren't going to get a nickel of that money, because the insurance company was off the hook when the jury said that he killed her intentionally for her money. The insurance company was only would have been liable if it was negligence.
Right.
So he was able to walk away, and he claimed he didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm. But that did kind of turn the
Yes,
tide.
It did. There's several things about that. It, for one thing, they had a new prosecutor in town in Logan County, Arkansas. He has told me that that after he took office, that he wanted to kind of clear the decks for his own term in office. And he got rid of a lot of old cases that were sitting there. And one of the cases that he looked at was the Marcia Good case. And he said he concluded that the case that Investigator Stevens had put together for the Arkansas State Police, that there was enough there to file charges against Bennett. But at the same time, no charges were filed until after the jury in the Toledo wrongful death case reached its verdict. And it wasn't long after that, however, when the new prosecutor went ahead and filed capital murder charges against Bennett, and it started from there. Now, that was 9 years after Marcia died before charges were filed. Even in the wrongful death case, the wrongful death civil suit, from the time it was filed until the time it came to trial was like about 3 years, because there were so many procedural things that had to take place before that could come to trial.
The book is The Deadly Groom by Joe Fenley, and it's available from... What's the name of your publisher?
iUniverse.com. And it's also available, you can, on the internet, you can get it at barnesandnoble.com, or you can order it through any major Dayton area bookstore.
So if you go to their website, iUniverse.com, you can look it up. Also, if you go to a bookstore and tell them you're looking for The Deadly Groom by Joe Fenley, if they don't carry it, they can order it for you. I guess the really disquieting thing for me, Joe, about this book was I read about this guy, I read about what he did and how he did it and the different stories he told every single person. And it's very disturbing to me because I had to think to myself, gee, it's easy to murder somebody and get away with it.
I think it probably is a good lesson in that, that it's, you don't, that it can happen, and that maybe more people than we know of walk away. Now, there are some people who get convicted of murder who are actually innocent, so it works both ways. Yeah. But it is also not unknown for someone to be able to get away with it for a long time. If it had not been for Dr. Good, and if it had not been for Investigator Stevens, and if it hadn't been for David Zoll and his legal abilities, I don't think it ever would have come to trial, and I don't think that he ever would have been convicted, and he'd probably be out there today preying on somebody else. Because, again, even after Marcia's death, he did marry two more times, and he victimized both of those women.
Wow. The book is The Deadly Groom by Joe Fenley. Joe, thanks for stopping by.
Well, I'm glad you let me come on your show.
Our pleasure.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Revisiting Joe Fenley's interview, his only appearance on the program 25 years ago, to talk about a book that was really a passion project for him. Joe had been a crime reporter for the Dayton Daily News during the 1970s when this murder took place. The murder took place in Arkansas, but the dead woman was from the Dayton area. And in Arkansas, they didn't seem to care about it that much. But eventually, the wheels of justice caught up with the deadly groom, the man who murdered his wife. He took her out fishing. She didn't like to fish. What was she doing out there on the water with this guy? And he kept doing it. He kept trying to kill his wives. He would buy life insurance policies on them. This guy was a creep. They finally caught up with him, though, and he died in prison. Joe Fenley went on to become managing editor of the Dayton Daily News. He died on February 5th, 2008. And I loved his voice and his cadence and the way that he spoke. He reminded me a little bit of Ed McBain. The only time I ever interviewed Ed McBain was back in 2001. I interviewed him on September 10th, 2001. He came into the station, and he had that same kind of voice, that same sort of hard-boiled sound to his voice where he would kind of swallow a little bit when he was speaking. And he had that New York accent. And I think Joe Fenley definitely had a little bit of the Staten Island accent left. And since he was from Dayton, I'm guessing he probably still has family around here. So if you know any relatives of Joe Fenley, you might want to tell him, hey, Joe was on the radio. He would have been happy to know that 25 years after he published The Deadly Groom, WYSO rebroadcast that interview. We did it live back in the day, and since it was a self-published book, he contacted me himself. He called me on the phone. He said, you know, I've written this book about this guy that killed his wife, and it's got a Dayton connection. You really need to have me on your radio show. And I said, okay, Joe, let's do it. And he came in, and he was very gracious and very matter-of-fact. And another thing I loved about him was he had that beat reporter's ability to remember everything, every little detail, every fact, every timeline. He remembered it all because he had lived it as a reporter and then going back to write this book, The Deadly Groom, an Ohio-Arkansas true crime saga. It was self-published, but I'm guessing the publisher, iUniverse, still has it in print if you're looking for it. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. It's always a pleasure to be here with you on 91.3 WYSO, your public radio station.